Mr. Cribb, reel one. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Bodmin in Cornwall.
And that was in which year?
23rd of May 1919.
What did your father do for a living?
He was in the Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry, Army, of course.
As a professional soldier?
Yeah, as a sergeant major, yes.
Did you have your education in Bodmin?
Only partly. I was so young then.
Where did you go to for
the
rest
of Scotland? Well, some in Bodmin, some in Germany, some in Alderney, some in Guernsey, the Channel Islands, as he was posted around, of course. He was in the occupation of the Rhine. So it was in all those different places.
How old were you when you left school?
I left when I was 14.
Did you get a job?
Yes, in those days. There was plenty of jobs available. It started off basically as an errand boy.
Even in 1933 it was easy?
Yes, comparatively. Mind you, we worked all day peddling a bike round Guildford for 2 shillings a day.
So you belong partly to Guildford?
Yes, I see. We came to Guildford and Dad left the army in 1928. We've been here ever since.
What were you doing when war was declared?
I was working in a shop in Guildford in the retail trade, selling electrical goods and such like.
You were telling me earlier that you joined the TA. Can you tell me how that came about?
Well, my brother joined first, and I just went down for company after a while, you know, just have something to do of an evening. Being interested in the army anyway, I mean, we're an army family. It dates right back, my father and then all on my mother's side as well. They're all army folk. Goes right back.
When do you think you joined the TA?
The year I joined, I think it was about 1937 or 38.
And which unit was it?
That was the 318 Searchlight Company, Territorial Army, Royal Engineers.
Can you tell me what the job of a searchlight company is?
Well, there's a crew of about 9 of you, and you just sort of listen out on the location equipment for aircraft approaching. And once the spotters have picked it up and you're on what we call on sound, it registers on the searchlight. You strike the beam, and with any luck, you're on the target. It was all, in those days, it was all First World War equipment. All the equipment we had, sound location stuff, was all First World War. So it was pretty rough, some of it. And relying on your own senses, what they call the binaural sound, getting exactly on, was a bit hit and miss because of the strong wind blowing and all that sort of thing. The sound would drift away, which is entirely what you relied on for an accurate beam going up onto the aircraft. Later on in the years in the war, when we had radar, it was much improved.
What was this sound locating equipment?
Well, it was a matter of about 4 big horns situated on a tripod, and you had earphones on, and you turned these things on a swivel so that you picked up the sound of the aircraft at its loudest. You were then what we call on sound, and you spoke into a microphone which was attached to the number 4. You operated what they called the long arm on the searchlight itself with a little wheel on it. You walked to get it that way, or you turned the wheel left and right for up or down. Now, you gave him instructions saying, because you could see the beam obviously, left, right, up, down. And it was a matter of then how accurate you were on your hearing and the instructions you gave and whether or not you came up on the plane on target. You had 2 spotters out, a number 2 and a number 3 binoculars, and they also helped to spot the aircraft. If they happened to spot it and you weren't on target, they would take over and give the number 4, the man who operated the searchlight, they would then take over and give him instructions as to get the beam on the target, if they could actually see it, which of course sometimes they could. They were about 100 yards out from the searchlight itself, so they had a better chance of getting up on beam and locating the target. It was still a bit hit and miss, this type of trying to get the beam onto the plane. I said, in the old days, the plane we had up used to put on its navigation lights to try and help us to get on target. It was all part of a training, though. It all helped in the long run, especially when the war started and we started to get new equipment, new searchlights, more powerful, more mobile. And then we had radar, which was dead accurate, of course. We could get on a target then 10 miles away.
What did these horns look like?
Sorry, the horns.
What did the horns look
like? Well, they're a bit like the type of horn they use today. That's the best way to describe them. They were like a funnel. So that's the front of it, looking at it. And then it narrowed down. You had four of those at slightly different distances apart to try and pick up the sound from a wider direction. And the sound then from those connect to earphones, to your ears, of course. And you'd swivel these things till it became the loudest. At the loudest point, you were dead on sound with the aircraft. But of course, you had to keep them moving. The plane was going up, down, or whichever direction. And you speak into a microphone to the number four operate the searchlight, giving him instructions to move up, down, left or right, to follow the soundtrack. But I say, it wasn't all that accurate, and it was First World War equipment we had. It was a bit hit and miss. I say, particularly if there was a strong wind blowing, the sound was very distorted, and you get a lot of noise in these type speakers. You could refer them as speakers, I suppose, in a sense, they were only for listening. I haven't got any pictures of them, which I've looked for quite a few times.
How did you like doing the job?
Oh, it was interesting. It's all right in the summer evenings. Mind you, in the winter it wasn't so much fun. But it was interesting, you know, anything to do with planes and such like.
Did you think a war was coming?
Well, we had the Munich crisis, what, in 1938. And we thought, well, things are getting a bit dicey. And then the second time we were called up, of course. And before that, we did a month's training at Botley. So it was getting serious. And then shortly afterwards, we got called up permanently then, myself, for nearly 7 years.
How did you feel about the announcement that we were at war with Germany?
Well, see, at that age, what was it, 19, 20 odd, I wasn't too worried about it. And just thought, anyway, as usual, everybody said, of course, it'll be over by Christmas. They said that all the time. But it was all right, you know. I think being an army family anyway, I wasn't too worried about it. I had two brothers, both older than me. One was in the Royal Army Service Corps and one the Royal Corps of Signals. In fact, my eldest brother had only just come out from India and then in Palestine. Finished with the army, and then of course he got called up again.
Were you in any of the early bombing by the German Air Force of British
over
satellites?
Here? Yes, over here. I mean, we were mostly like the Birmingham. We were in the middle of Birmingham while that was going on, while they were bombing that, and Sheffield, Coventry, because we worked with ACAC, sometimes with 3.7 guns, anti-aircraft guns as well. Combined effort. And sometimes, especially in Birmingham, we're with the when they were firing up these great making boxes in the sky of rockets that we were using. They go up 20, 30, 40 at a time in sections over the cities. When the aircraft entered that particular box, they'd fire all these. But very often then, we didn't use the searchlight. We might use it to plot the aircraft, plot the enemy planes. And then we give those signals very often to fighter command, who would then use it to get a plane or fighter plane, if it was out of the ACAC area, onto the planes. And very often we had our own plane assigned to us, and we'd be talking to fighter command. Although we didn't illuminate the searchlight, we were using it as a radar tracker. Give it to them, they get onto the pilot, and he'd know exactly where the enemy aircraft was, and very often he'd shoot it down without seeing it. It was quite remarkable. That's radar. Of course, we used to get quite excited about that.
Which of those three cities that you mentioned, Birmingham, Coventry and Sheffield, was most badly bombed whilst you were there?
I think Birmingham. I seem to remember it was the worst anyway. I know I was walking around there going to see a friend there, a girlfriend one night, and there was a hell of a raid on, and I'd use the train to get in there, that wasn't far, and I know I had to get out and walk the rest of the way, and it was shocking. I was just wandering around the streets, I couldn't even find my way, there's broken glass, bricks, and in the end, air raid warden came up to me and told me to get down to a shelter, which I did, but I soon got fed up with that. And funny enough, I came out and I found a tram running until they found the streets blocked with debris and that. But they were very good. They said, well, that's the direction you want. I think it was Handsworth I was trying to find that night. And I found these people in the end. this girlfriend and their family there. They were down in an air raid shelter. But that raid lasted, I was there 2 days and it didn't stop. It went on day and night. They took a real hiding in Birmingham. To me, it was the worst at that time. Although Sheffield, of course, was bad. But funny enough, after that, we went right down to Sharhampton near Bristol, and they put us on firefighting on the docks, of all things. We used to go down there and fight the fires on the docks. That's... because Bristol took a real packet, and they just wiped the centre out of Bristol. But Sharhampton, was the docks adjoining the city. So we used to march down there every night. We were under canvas, and we stayed there all night, sleep on the docks, and then run around with sandbags trying to put fires out on the top. I always remember because Fife's the banana people had a lovely big office down there. Because we used to try and billet in there. But, there's like a railway station down there, really. It's a huge area, the docks at Avonmouth. And all these trucks are filled with that molasses stuff. Because I know we went to the top once and look in there. Old Jerry came over one night and he dropped thousands of incendiaries on it. We were running in all directions trying to put them out. And I always remember my mate standing next to me. He had one drop on top of his steel helmet, which didn't do him any good. And another one came down. I don't know if you've seen these incendiary things. They've got very sharp fins on them. And as it came down, it cut his finger all the way right down to the bone. There's some funny things used to happen. But I didn't have any bother down there.
Were any of the ships in the dock hit as well at Sharhampton?
Well, not... in the section, it's a huge area. There was none in the area hit or caught fire there. It was nearly always the buildings that seemed to catch it, I suppose the dockyard facilities, the tracks, the railways, and there's a lot of food stored there, of course. They used to catch fire. You just couldn't do anything about it. But... it was a very busy area. We had raids most nights while I was down there. We were only there for less than 7 or 8 months, and then we posted somewhere else. It used to go on all the time.
When you say you were in Coventry, you weren't there on the infamous raid destroyed Coventry?
No, I've tried to think about that myself, but I don't think I was. I'm afraid I'm a bit hazy on some of the dates over the years. You tend to forget exactly where you were at times. Some of the towns, no, I can't quite remember. I know we've been out on holiday sometimes, it looks vaguely familiar sometimes, but being a sort of a very mobile type of unit, they use this for all sorts of jobs.
You have any personal narrow escapes in that bombing by the German Air Force?
Not really. It was one of those chancy things. I think the nearest I got to it, I was up at Grimsby, having a rest house there, giving us a break from all these other duties. And there's one Jerry plane came over one night. Actually, this was about late 1940. And we heard it up there. We didn't take much notice of it. And we used to get an odd one over on reconnaissance most nights. And suddenly we heard a hell of a whistle, and we knew what it was. And he dropped one. He only got one bomb, I think. We heard after for the station. But we were just inside the park gates in this house. And this bomb dropped right in the centre of the road, which was a miracle, really, because, there was houses each side, but dropped right in the middle. We all got blown out of our beds and everything else, and half the building and the windows went. But anyway, we got out and ran down the road to see what, you know, if we could give any help anywhere. But I was quite amazed to see that the centre of the road had completely gone, and all the old gas pipes and things on view, and all the houses each side were shattered. Fortunately, we went in the house to see if we could find anybody, but they're all in the air raid shelters, because obviously the siren had gone that bit early, and nobody was hurt at all. It was a miracle. But that was the nearest, really. I mean, apart from the war itself, when we went to Normandy, I mean...
You said that was late 1940?
That was late 1940 when we were up there, yes. Mm.
And you said near the railway station? Was that Grimsby Town Railway
Town Railway Station, yes. But they missed it, but I suppose it was quite... The plane was quite high up, you know, could only just hear it, but the air raid warning had gone. But that was the closest in this country. I mean, abroad, it was a bit different.
How did public morale stand up from your personal observation in the Blitz?
Well, it was very good, except I remember we were down on the docks, and this was the second time the doodle bugs had started, and we were down on the docks getting ready to get our gear on board again. And I was talking to one of the dockyard policemen, and he said, what with the Blitz, and now these doodle bugs started... He said people were in a pretty bad state. And he said if these things continue, they were thinking of evacuating parts of London completely. He said the people had so much, they just couldn't take all this again.
Was this in London Docks?
This is the London Docks, yeah.
In the East End?
Yes, yes. They did have a bad time. That's what he said anyway, that's what they thought would have to happen. They just couldn't take any more.
But from your first-hand experience of morale, what do you think it was like?
I found the people were pretty good. I mean, you found out a bit by going in the pubs and such like. But they did have a lot to put up with, I must say. It was continuous, and then the V1s, and of course then they had the V2s coming over. And the only way to stop them is for eventually, when one invaded, is to overrun the sites.
When you were doing your searchlight job, how much success do you think that your unit had in combating the raids?
It was very successful once we got onto the radar-equipped searchlights then, because it was far more accurate. We had it was like the miniature television screen. You could pick up the signals. I mean, we've got big aerials on the front of the searchlight, and we sent out a signal, and once it hit the aircraft, another signal came back, which registered then on our radar screen. And that, we put what we called a strobe on it, and the other two of the crew, one for height and elevation, etc., they also had screens, and when I'd accurately strobed that signal, the number 7 and 8 could use their wheels to operate the searchlight, so they could keep what we call on target as well. They keep the exact signal, as I'd already picked it up on my screen, sent it to theirs, and they could move the searchlight up or left, right, whatever, so that when we said to put the beam on, it should go up accurately on the plane. And if your equipment was set up correctly, the Rima used to look after it, you could go straight onto that plane. It was, you know, and that's up to a distance of 10 miles. It was very, very good. And that's why we used it also to contact the fighter command, who used their same signals to orbit their plane also onto the target. It was so accurate, the radar. Very accurate. We had quite a bit of success with it, I would say. Because very often the fighter command would send a message through to us, either congratulating us on our accuracy of our signalling, or if we didn't hear from them, we know that they didn't have any success.
You mentioned four towns in which you helped to defend, Birmingham, Coventry, Sheffield and Bristol. Do you remember any of the locations in which your searchlight battery was located?
Well, only the towns. I mean, we're always scattered around the nearby in farms or fields, etc. So it's difficult to be accurate about it. It was just a map reference which we went to and set up the equipment if it wasn't already there, of course. But, I mean, we must have been in, well, at least 15, 20 different towns all the time we're in this country. And we'd have a lot of sites around our HQ. So, I mean, you could be posted to another one for a couple of weeks or whatever. It was some of the towns and little villages. It's a job to remember them now. But they were scattered round outside the big cities.
On the outskirts of the city?
Oh, the outskirts. Well, I mean, for searchlight operation, you needed to be... If you're too near a town, there's too much disturbance on the signals. And you needed fairly flat terrain. I mean, hills would register on your radar and upset your signals, all that sort of thing. We did a lot of work up in Norfolk. We had a lot of sites in Norfolk, of course. Up at Maramere, drone for a while, defending the perimeter up there. That's when they had the Wellingtons and Stirlings up there.
Did the general public appreciate the job that you were doing, or did you get any
complaints
and friction?
One place in Diddington in Yorkshire, very hospitable crowd, I must admit. The people in Yorkshire, they always looked after us very well. But they're always frightened we're going to put the beam up, because they said if that happens, they reckon they could be bombed or machine gunned or anything. Because, I mean, obviously the Germans would retaliate to try and put the searchlight out, either with bombing or shooting or cannon fire or something. So they always hoped that when there's a radar, we wouldn't put the beam up, because it does light up the area quite a bit. But sometimes we only did the tracking and didn't use the beam.
That was Diddington, you said?
Diddington in Yorkshire.
Diddington?
Yes.
It's near Sheffield, it's in South Yorkshire.
Yes, because a lot of our chaps helped with the Sheffield raids, you know, helped the wardens. What's that? Diddington, Diddington.
Yes, I've been there.
Oh, yes. Oh, they're a very, very nice crowd of people there, I must say. Very hospitable. We used to swap some of our rations for their homemade bread, I know. Some of the things you remember.
Now, you were telling me earlier off the record that you transferred at one stage from the Royal Engineers to the Royal to the Royal Artillery. Can you tell me
that was
when and how that came about?
Well, it was just one of those... Well, it was quite a puzzle to us as well. I think we were up at Grimsby at the time. That was 1940. And it just came up on standing orders. We would be transferred to the Royal Artillery from the Royal Engineers. But... I mean, they never give a reason for these things. We just change cap badges and other things. And everything carried on as before. Perhaps they thought one day we'd go on guns and stay with guns rather than searchlights.
Was it just a formality, or did it make any material difference?
It didn't seem to make any difference at all to our way of life at all. I mean, nothing changed from what we were doing. It was probably done for convenience or something from the War Office. I never did find a reason for it.
How, you were telling me also that the unit was disbanded in 42 or 43.
Yes, it was, down at Fording Bridge. I just remember that now. Yes, it was a great shame. I mean, being a territorial unit, we've been together for many, many years. And it was a great disappointment. I remember Major Alfred, our CO, he was very uptight about it. We found out afterwards we could have remained intact, but it was a bit late then. Yes, we had a big parade then in the park down at Fording Bridge, and we then split up and went to different parts of the country. That's when I came to this area, Deep Cut, for my initial BOFA training. Switched from searchlights completely to the 40mm BOFA gun. And I think that's what happened basically with all the lads, all the rest of our troop. We have a reunion once a year now still of the existing 318 unit. But there's only about several hundred. We're down to about 16, I think, now. A lot of them have moved away or just died.
How did your own career in the army then progress? after you transferred to Burford's work?
Well, it's, and unfortunately, I mean, most of us were sergeants or lance sergeants, which is always a bit dicey. In other words, if you get posted to another unit and they've got their full complement of sergeants, you drop down to your war substantive rank, which is a bombardier, or corporal is going in the Royal Artillery, of course, your bombardiers. So we all had to revert, lose our tape from sergeant down to bombardier. And after our training, we all got posted again to different units, and if they had full strength of their sergeants, you just stayed as a bombardier. I got made up once when I was in Italy to a sergeant again, but again it was only temporary. Getting posted again, I dropped back to bombardier again. In fact, so I finished up in the army.
What was your unit in the Buffers?
That was the 92nd Light ACAC unit. 92nd.
How did you like being in that as compared with the previous unit?
Well, it wasn't quite the same. I mean, originally we're all sort of from Surrey, Yule unit and Guildford unit, and we've known the chaps for years. When I went up to Scotland and joined them, then there were mostly chaps from Liverpool and all other areas. And I found it very, very difficult to get along with them at times. Our ideas were so different.
Can you give an example?
Well, it's difficult to, really. I made one or two quite good friends there, but they were very sort of rough and ready crowd. I mean, there was nothing wrong with them, obviously, but their way of life had been quite different. What they believed and what I believed seemed quite different. I mean, on our ABTA talks, general chats each week that we had, I mean, quite often they were still, which went against the grain for me. One of the things we discussed, should there be strikes in wartime? And they fully agreed that there should be. And of course, I fully disagreed with that. I didn't think there should be strikes in wartime. It was, the politics crept into it. I'd never been interested in politics at that time. I hadn't got a clue what it was about. But I think that's, even then, that's what it was about.
You mentioned APCA, that's the Army Bureau.
Army Bureau of Current Affairs, yes. So I always found they're very interesting. Even abroad we had those, in Italy and such places. They'd have their Army Bureau of Current Affairs, so I found they were very good. But, as I say, I did my initial training again with them, and then we split up once we got Normandy again, so it didn't make too much difference. Your own gun crews, I mean, you got to know quite well. But it wasn't quite the same as our original TA unit.
What was the justification of these Liverpool people about having strikes in wartime?
Well, they thought it was fully justified to have a strike then as any other time for the rights of the workers, as you might say. I mean, whatever the rights or wrongs of that, I thought during the wartime there shouldn't be. So it was a very hot debate there. People get hot under the cover. Politics and religion should be left well alone, I always think.
How did you then prepare for D-Day, please?
Well, that was our initial training up in Scotland. I mean, there was all the night work we did, and night firing, and beach training and landings. It was the usual thing. Although we were both for guns, we did all